My goodness, every time I see that, I'm like, oh, I need to go hit somebody. There's something about people who have a goal higher than themselves, something about people who are faithful, something about people who stay on plan, hit the same nail, that just really inspires me. This is what we're looking at in this series. We're seeing how we're attracted to superheroes because they tend to be people who are faithful, and we're attracted to that. And last week we looked at how God, at his core, is faithful. And today we're going to start turning the corner and say, what would it be like for us to be faithful? So let's pray before I say anything else. God, I'm thankful for people like John the Baptist. I'm thankful for this book called The Bible that gives people a different idea of how to live their lives. It gives me a different idea how to live my life. And I'm thankful that every person in here has sacrificed a beautiful day outdoors at least for 65 minutes to be inside of a dark room. And I pray that as a result of that, we come closer to you, we come closer to understanding and being faithful people. And any way that you want to use me, God, that would be great. And I pray these things according to your faithful name. Amen. You know, whatever your belief structure is, it's one thing I love about Crossroads. We have people who have all different spiritual orientations and people have all different convictions. And you're not probably going to agree with everything that's said today. But one thing I think we can all agree with, the people who are faithful that we are inspired by are people who are about something other than themselves. Faithfulness means that there is something, someone, some being, some entity, some philosophy, something other than you that you are aligning your life to. If there isn't something outside of you, no one would see you as faithful, because you make all your decisions based on what feels good to me right now. Based on what is the path of least resistance for me, based on what is happy for me. But faithfulness is about realizing there's something, someone else out there that I'm bending myself towards. And the person we're looking at today is a classic example of this. John the Baptist, not John the Catholic, not John the Presbyterian, but John the Baptist. Actually, it wasn't Baptist because he was a part of a denomination, but he was baptizing people as an Old Testament prophet. Yes, even though we're going to read about him today in the New Testament portion of the Bible, he actually is best seen as an Old Testament prophet. He's giving words from God that actually precede the full life, death, resurrection, ascension of Jesus. He's in the line of the old prophets. They're telling the nation of Israel, guys, you've lost the plot. The whole Ten Commandment thing, you're forgetting about those, you're not being faithful. It's time for you to change, it's time for you to turn. And in keeping with that, he was baptizing people, which is different than the baptism that happens today with many people. It was a baptism where you said, I'm not keeping the Ten Commandments, I just want to wash all that dirt off of me, which is really not the same of what happens when someone gets baptized at a place like Crossroads. But he's being faithful, he's pointing to who Jesus is, or at least the coming Messiah. And let's pick up his speech in the book of John, which is not the same John as John the Baptist, if you're not already confused. And here's what it says. So they said to him, who are you? We need to give an answer to those who sent us. Who do you say about yourself? What do you say about yourself? He said, I'm the voice of one crying out in the wilderness. Make straight the way of the Lord, as the prophet Isaiah said. It's interesting how many things in our culture, we don't even realize it, are tracing back to Bible sayings. This is one of them. A voice crying out in the wilderness. This comes from the Bible. We'll still talk about that today. Somebody who is the lone voice, who is the voice of quote-unquote reason, who's by themselves, a voice calling in the wilderness. The reason John's saying this, he's basically saying, it's as if I'm talking to trees. Because nobody else is getting this stuff. Nobody else is doing this stuff that I'm asking you to do. I am a lone voice calling the wilderness. I know I look weird because faithful people always look weird. Faithful people are always not going against the grain, the path of least resistance. And he says, I'm quoting and I'm doing what the Old Testament prophet Isaiah did, which is make straight the paths of the Lord. And you saw that little vignette and that little comic strip, which is a larger blowout version of that from another gospel in the Bible. And what that means is an ancient thing that powerful people to do. He's not talking about being on the straight and narrow as if doing the moral thing. What he's referring to is something that royalty used to be able to do in the ancient world. Have you ever seen some of those movies where you've got the royal person inside of the big, huge living room that's being carried on poles by slaves, you know, kind of walking along, and they're in there playing their PlayStation, and they would just sort of be walking along. And if you notice those, when you see it in the movies, those slaves are always trying to walk in step because that way there's not as much jostling of the poles because the royalty wanted a nice, smooth ride. And so what they would do, and specifically what Greek legends and history says the queen of Assyria did in 800 BC, she was actually charting a journey and she went ahead of herself. She sent workers and slaves ahead of herself to level mountains, level hills that she was going to go through, and then take that fill and fill in valleys and take the rough roads and make them smooth for two reasons. One, so that it would be a smoother ride for her. And two, when she was done, people would always see that there was a public work project and they could all use it. And every time they use it, they would remember and reflect on the glory, the majesty, the richness of Queen Sammurammat. I still can't get that right. I think that's how you say that. And this is what Isaiah and what John the Baptist is saying it looks like when you're faithful to God. When you're faithful to God, you do things, not to be a moralizer, but you do things because you want to reflect God's image. You want to live a life so when people look at your life or walk on your life or remember your life, they remember God because you're being a faithful reproduction of God. Not faithful to your own reputation, not faithful to your own fame, but actually faithful to God. Let's talk about four-letter words that we don't like in America, or at least that we can't say from stage. There's a number of four-letter words. There's the H word, you know, H-E double toothpick. There's that word. There's the D word. The H and the D word are, yes, it's not a three-letter word. It's a four-letter word. The H and the D word are kind of the same level of offensiveness. Not all that offensive. I might say that every once in a while from stage. But then you get the S word. Ooh, S word. That's got a little more intensity. And then the worst word in our culture, we think, is the F word. Fart. Not that word. Actually, I say that quite often. But now really, you know the most offensive word in our culture? The offensive four-letter word is the O word. Obey. Obey. If you want to shut down a conversation or just make people be depressed, talk about obedience. Talk about obeying. Obeying is something that only weak people who don't have any other options to do in our society. Our attitude towards obedience or obeying can be seen in Shepard Fairey's image of Andre the Giant. Remember him in the 70s? Those of us who are old enough. Professional wrestling, Andre the Giant, 7 foot plus, 400 plus pounds, drank a case of beer a day. God bless America. I mean, this guy was mean. He was ornery. And obey is linked with him because it's just this ugly thing. It's this thing that you get wrenched into. It's something that you get beat into versus what I'm hoping we see today is embracing. Embracing obeying. I'm talking today about faithful obedience. To be faithful to God, or actually to be faithful to anything, is to obey the principles of that thing, of that person. And so I want to recapture the glory, if you will, of the idea of obeying. How would you know if you're unfaithful? Most of us would all say we're faithful. Well, I'm faithful, all faithful. Well, how would you know that you're unfaithful? It's kind of like the old illustration of the frog that's in the boiling kettle. You know, if the water gets increased, the frog gradually boils to death, doesn't even notice it. If he drops into a boiling pot of water, then he'll immediately jump out. And the question for us is, how would we know that we're unfaithful? How would you know? Most of us, we have little compromise after little compromise, and we don't even notice or admit that we've become unfaithful. It's been a gradual slide. Now, John keeps his faithfulness, but we're going to see in a little bit that he actually has major doubts. He even starts to waver a little bit. You can have doubts, you can start to waver a little bit, but yet still be faithful. John has this amazing moment where he encounters Jesus. Let's actually take a look at John chapter 1, verse 26, 27. It says this, John answered them, "I baptize with water, but among you Jews, stands one you do not know, even he who comes after me, the strap of whose sandal I am not worthy to untie." I'm not worthy. I'm not worthy. Does a little Wayne's World thing. He says, folks, you don't understand. Out of our Jewish lineage is coming one. He's probably here right now. The Messiah, the Savior, the Anointed One, God's Son, God Himself. I tell you, when He comes around, I'm faithful to Him. I'm not faithful to my reputation. I'm not faithful to my following. I am faithful to Him. Three things about faithful obedience. One is deference. Faithful obedience is deference. Faithful obedience is when we defer to someone or something else. when we're not about ourselves, but we defer elsewhere. He says, hey, when this guy comes, I got to tell you, there's no need for me to really be well known. In fact, I'm not even worthy to untie his sandals. Faithful deference. You know what you're faithful to when you lose things. You know, sometimes we might own a business, and you lose customers to another business. Basically, they get deferred, you lose them, and what happens to you? You get really, really bothered. You get bothered, why? Because you said that your goal was to serve the customer, but really, it really should have been your goal was the bottom line to make money. Well, there's nothing wrong with making money at all. It's just it makes it very clear, because if you really wanted to serve your customer, first and foremost, if they could get the same product for less money, you would applaud them going there, because you'd be faithful to the ideal of serving the customer, including referring them or deferring them elsewhere. Few of us could ever lose something, because we don't want to lose anything, because our goal, our faithfulness, is all about increasing our holdings. I have to ask myself that every time I know somebody who's part of Crossroads and leaves. I have to say, yeah, I'm kind of bummed out about that right now. But I got to ask myself, am I about getting people to God? Or am I about getting more people in a room that I happen to be in? And man, if people are getting to God outside of anything that has to do with me, awesome. That's what faithfulness is. Get to God. Whatever you're faithful to, you will defer to. You will defer your plans, your visions, your future to. John sees Jesus, amazing thing happens. The Holy Spirit, apparently he sees the Holy Spirit descending on him like a dove. It's a powerful, powerful thing. Jesus goes away, and the reason Jesus gets baptized is not because he needed to change anything, but he wanted to identify with other Jews who needed to go through that rite. So now Jesus goes away, and he starts leading, he starts teaching, he starts healing. And here's what it says in John 3:26. And they came to John, that's his disciples, John's friends. Rabbi, he who was with you across the Jordan, to whom you bore witness, look, he's baptizing and all are going to him. John answered, a person cannot receive even one thing unless it's given to him from heaven. Therefore, this joy of mine is now complete. He must increase, but I must decrease. That is a great line. He must increase, I must decrease. He says, why are you guys getting upset that people are leaving? He thinks, these guys think that John's going to be bummed out. Oh, no, you're kidding. Everyone's leaving us. You mean my following is going down? He says, hey, if that guy's growing, it's because it's been given to heaven. And he says to all his friends, hey, here this, guys. He says, I want to defer everyone over to him. My fame should decrease, and I want his to increase. My followership should decrease, and I want his to increase. The perks that come to me by being a motivational spiritual guru, John says, should decrease. I want him to increase. You know, you're faithful to God or faithful wherever you are. Whenever you are choosing downward mobility, that is a sign of faithfulness. When we immediately assume having less is bad, it's a sign that you're boiling. Faithful obedience means I'm willing and able to defer. It's not about me. And faithful obedience is congruence. It's congruence. It's when everything in my life is going the same direction. When I'm faithful in what I'm thinking, I'm faithful in what I'm saying, I'm faithful in what I'm doing, what I'm saying is matching what I'm doing, what I'm feeling is matching what I'm believing. It's congruence. And all of us are always tempted to not be congruent. I have numerous temptations on this. A couple weeks ago, I was coming back from Florida. We stay in a friend's house down there for free. My favorite three letters, F-R-E. We stayed down there. We were down there for a couple weeks, and I didn't want to come back early as my youngest daughter, our youngest daughter, Mariah, needed, because she needed to come back for volleyball camp. So I thought, well, let's use some frequent flyer miles or do whatever we need to do. Let's get her on a plane from Miami, head her back up here. We jumped through all the hoops of how you do that with a 13-year-old, a minor, extra people looking after her, and how to get to the airport early enough to fill out all the forms, all that kind of stuff. So I leave the house pretty early, and my car breaks down. I'm like, oh, gosh. Breaks down, and fortunately, I figure out something else to get to the airport. I get to the airport. We get through all the rigmarole. We get through security. We get to the gate 45 minutes ahead of time, and I said, whew, we made it. So we're sitting there on those little blue vinyl seaty things, which if I was ever in charge of an airport, I would have more comfortable seats. That is just ridiculous. If you're looking to serve the customer, how about giving us something nice to put our rear end on, you know? I'm sitting in those seats, and I'm waiting. All of a sudden, I hear, excuse me, ladies and gentlemen. Which, by the way, whenever you hear that at an airport, bad news is about to follow.
I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen. We have an update from the captain. As you can see, our plane is
out right now on the other end of the gatewalk, but there's a cracked windshield, and so they're going to have to replace the windshield, and our flight time has moved from 12:30 to 7 o'clock tonight. Thank you.
Actually, what they should say, they always lie, is,
we're going to tell you 7 o'clock, but it's going to be longer than that. We just thought you'd be less angry if we said 7 o'clock.
I turn to the woman next to me, what did they just say? I said, 7 o'clock, crack windshield. I'm like, oh, man. So my first goal is to get on the cell phone to Delta before anybody else. Because if there's any other flights, I need to get her on one of those so I'm not stuck in this airport for 7 hours. So I call Delta. No go. No other flight coming out of any reasonable time period. So now I'm saying, 7 hours I got stuck here? I think, you know, I've always wanted to go to that little crown room thing. I've got, I don't quite have enough miles to get free access into the crown room. I've looked into it. I've never actually done it, but I know there's a day pass you can buy. And I'm thinking, gosh, 7 hours sitting here, I could probably work something. I'm going to go to the crown room, just going to hang there and have some free beer and olives for 7 hours. So decide to go up to the crown room, and there's these long lines. Apparently, a bunch of people had the same philosophy. Hey, I'll go to the crown room. So I go up, and I say, well, let's just go around this line here. When it dies down, I'll come back and, take care of it then. So we're sitting in these nice little leather chairs, we're watching free television, reading free Economist magazine, having free Pepsis, Cokes, free olives, free beers, free anything you can think of free, enjoying it. And after about 2 hours, I think, you know, I bet that line has kind of gone down by now. I'll get it later. So 3 hours comes, I say, man, I ought to go back and do, but man, I wonder how much that's going to be. I mean, I'm going to just kind of sit here longer. And as time goes on, I start to think, maybe I shouldn't just go back there at all. I mean, after all, the windshield is cracked. The least they could do is give me free olives. The least they could do is just let me be here for 7 hours. But I'm realizing this thing is going inside of me that for me to do this is really the same as stealing. I'm stealing stuff from them that I haven't paid. And I'm feeling this lack of congruence, this lack of faithfulness, just out of the temptation. So finally, after 5 hours, I say, well, I ought to go back there and handle this. So I go back to the front desk. There's no line there. And I say, oh, sorry, sir. I didn't want to wait in line the whole time, but we've been here for the last 5 hours having all of your olives. And I just need to figure out, is there any charge or how much is it? All that kind of. He said, well, how long have you been here? I said, well, I don't know, 4 or 5 hours. He said, well, you haven't caused any trouble, so don't worry about it. Today's on us. Going, awesome. God bless America. That's why I love this country. It was great. Phenomenal. That situation, I have my cake or my olives, and I ate it too. It was great. But the point is, there was tension inside of me of whether or not my life was going to match my beliefs. My life was going to match my heart. One of the biggest, most popular terms in social psychology is cognitive dissonance. Cognitive dissonance is when you are cognitive, when you are mentally aware that there is dissonance in your life. There is a lack of congruence. Because as the theory goes, we as human beings, we want to be in alignment. We want to believe the things that we say. We want to do the things that we're saying. We have this desire to be in alignment. And when we're out of alignment, we are aware that we're out of alignment, and there's this dissonance, kind of like guitar chords that are out of tune that just don't feel right by us. And so we have one of two options. We can either ignore it and live in dissonance, in which case we get a personality disorder, or two, we can change something to come into alignment. It's also known as the Ben Franklin effect. Ben Franklin, when he had a major political opponent, he learned that if he went to his opponent and asked for something and had his opponent do something nice for him, there would be dissonance, and something would have to happen in the relationship. So as the story goes, he went to an opponent who had a big library, and everyone knew him as a big library guy, and he went to him and asked if he had a specific book that he could borrow. And he said, why, certainly I do. So he borrowed the book. Ben Franklin read the book, brought it back to him, commented nicely on the book, returned the book in good order, and now there was a bond between the two. Now this political opponent had something in common with Ben Franklin. They had love of books. They had love of libraries. And now his political opponent couldn't take shots at him, because to take shots at Ben Franklin meant to diss a fellow reader, a fellow enjoyer of his library. So he forced himself to come into alignment and think highly of Ben Franklin, because all of us want to be in congruence. Now, why am I saying all this? I'm saying it because a lot of us, when we say that we're having problems with our faith, we say that we're having a hard time believing things we used to believe are not having faith problems, we're having action problems. Sometimes when I know a bit of the story and I feel a little bit bold and feel like just saying something unusual, and someone will come to me and say, you know, I just don't feel it like I used to. You know, I just have doubts about the stuff that I used to believe that was true in the Bible, and I just don't think it's true anymore. And if I know the story, I'll say, tell me, how long have you been banging your girlfriend? See, here's the deal. When you have this faith, if you have this faith that says, you know, I value what's in here, I value the truth, and you say you have that, you say you have that belief, and then you get some sexual jollies with somebody you're not married to, you are in dissonance. Honestly, this is cognitive dissonance. You have two opposing things, the faith that I had, the belief that I had, or the sexual fun I'm having right now, and there will be dissonance inside of you. And it is always easier to change your beliefs than change your actions. Always. Changing your beliefs, changing your convictions, it's always easier to change your beliefs than change your actions. And so what we'll do in this situation like this is we'll choose to think, oh, the Bible's out there, because it's easier to keep going with the flow of this. That's just us in the sexual area. See, we're not losing our faith, we're being faithless. That's a total difference. Or so we'll see, well, I know Jesus says, love your enemies, pray for those who persecute you, but my boss is a jerk. I'm sorry, but I can't pray for my boss. I can't love. What you have to do when you're in cognitive dissonance is you have to find a reason why Jesus' word to love your enemy doesn't apply to somebody you're working for. You say, well, I can't pray for him. I mean, he's an employer. He should know better. I can't love my enemy. Or, you know, I'm not a racist. I just do notice reality. I just notice that people like that are this or that. So for cognitive dissonance, we have to figure out a way how the rules don't apply to us or how the rules were wrong. We have to do this because we can't handle this dissonance. And I'm asking us to consider, is the issues of doubt, are the struggles with your faith, are the veracity of your faith, are they really rooted in new information you didn't know before? Are they really rooted in you not being faithful and trying to find a way to justify it? All of us, I believe, have some God concept, or most of us do. The rate of atheists and agnostics in America really hasn't changed that much over the decades. And of course, we have, you know, atheists and agnostics in here, and it's awesome. That's one of the things I love about Crossroads. But whatever your God concept is, or your spirituality is, or your religion is, or your higher power is, or your whatever that is, question for you is, how does your God give you dissonance? How does your God give you disconfirming information? See, most of the spiritual books that are on the bestseller list, man, they always make you feel good. They always tell you what you're doing is right. They always give you a new way to spin to justify all of your behavior. And the problem is, if we don't have something like the Bible that is stable, that is faithful, that is always the same, how do you ever hear that you could be wrong? How do you ever hear there's anything that, it's just too convenient to just pick you all your little pieces of spirituality, because isn't it interesting how they always justify what you're doing right now? It always does. If you are going to be faithful to some God, you must find what is the mouthpiece that God uses that is standard and will speak against you when you are wrong. And if you can't see that you're wrong, there's a major, major faithfulness gap. Now, John the Baptist, he has major issues. He's got problems that he's going through. And he really comes into some major pain. Not only are people leaving him as he's applauded, going to Jesus, he is decreasing and Jesus is increasing, but he's got this other problem where the ruler of the Jews, the political ruler of the Jews, is Herod, who's also authorized by Rome to oversee the whole region. Herod is Jewish, but he's absolutely lost all of his faith, and he's threatened that there is this Jewish prophet that's taking glory and credit away from him. He doesn't like it at all. He doesn't like that people have been going to him. So what he does is he sends them out, he gets them arrested, and he throws them into his personal dungeon, into his personal prison. And he just kind of keeps them there. And interestingly enough, as time goes on, we get the picture that he's probably going down in the dungeon and talking with John every once in a while. He's intrigued. We're always intrigued with faithful people. Even if they're faithful to something that we don't agree with, we're intrigued with someone who's actually committed. We're intrigued with somebody who actually lives what they say. It's always intriguing. And so Herod doesn't quite have the gumption to put John to death. And so John is withering away inside of a prison, inside of a dungeon, and his faith starts to take a hit. He starts to have doubts. And he calls for somebody to go send Jesus a message. And let's take a look at what it says in the book of Matthew, chapter 11. When John heard in prison that the Messiah, what the Messiah was doing, he hears that Jesus is teaching, he hears that Jesus is healing people, doing miracles, he sent his disciples to ask him, "Are you the one who was to come, or should we expect someone else?" In other words, what's happening here is his exclamation that Jesus is the Son of God is validated by all the miracles that are happening, but he's wondering why those miracles aren't coming his way. Why aren't those miracles coming? If you're releasing people from all kinds of issues, how come you're not getting me released out of this dungeon? So he's starting to have doubts. He's starting to wonder, maybe he's not the guy. So he needs another gut check in his faith. And he says, "Are you the one? I'm starting to get fuzzy on this." Let me tell you something. When your life is out of congruence, you will always be fuzzy on this issue. Always. Jesus hears word, and Jesus sends back to him, "Go back and report to John what you hear and see. The blind receive sight, the lame walk. Those who have leprosy are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and the good news is proclaimed to the poor. Blessed is anyone who does not stumble on account of me." Jesus sends back word, which is a piecing together of a bunch of prophecies that speak to the Messiah. And he says, look at these are all getting done. Poor being healed, the blind are being seen. These are verses or passages that John understood. He said, look, all these things that were said about me, they're happening. There's an interesting thing, though, that one phrase that is regularly used to speak of the Messiah, and Jesus actually uses of himself very regularly, is not included in this list. You know what that phrase is? To set the captives free. I've come to set the captives free. Jesus conveniently and strategically leaves out one of the prophecies about him. What he's saying is, John, I'm not coming. I'm not coming. I'm sorry. You are a captive who is not going to be set free. Third thing with faithful obedience is, faithful obedience is acceptance. John has to wrestle with whether or not he will accept his fate, that things aren't going to work out for him the way he would script them. He has to accept that he is not going to be released from prison. In fact, sometime after that, he actually gets killed. There's a party, and Herod's a little tipsy, and he makes a commitment to somebody in his family through a strange set of circumstances, and he ends up giving a gift of John's head on the platter, even though he doesn't want to, but he has to fulfill his drunken word to somebody. John has to accept it. I'll tell you what, you know when you're faithful? When crappy things are happening in your life, and you say, I will accept it. Crappy things, I will stay the course. I will keep hitting the same nail. You know you're faithful? When you're getting a divorce, and you're not angry and blaming it all on God. You know you're faithful when the last thing the oncologist tried, he tried, and there's nothing there, and you're not blaming God and shaking your fist any longer and accusing him. You know you're faithful when you haven't gotten a job yet for another year. You're doing all right, but you're not assuming that God has abandoned you. You're keeping the course. You're keeping going. You accept it. You accept and say, if my circumstances don't get better, one thing that does not matter is I'm not changing. I'm going after the same God I've always gone after. I'm reflecting God the same way I always have. It's not about me and my happiness. It's not about me and my ease. I am deferring to God. I am in congruence with God. And that means I will accept. I will accept hard things that may not be solved for a year, a decade, or even in my lifetime. One of the things that's said in the Bible regularly is waiting on the Lord, waiting on the Lord. And oftentimes this is a military phrase, which is to denote a sentry who's standing watch. The sentries, they stand watch. Not a lot happens, but they need to be faithful standing watch. Imagine a sentry who decides just to leave his watch, and he comes up on court-martial. And what would he say to the justice of the court? What was he going to say? Well, you know, I just wasn't getting anything out of it. So I just had to leave. I just weren't getting anything out of it. Your role was to be faithful. Your role, not in case I don't get anything. I can't tell you how many times I hear, you know, I used to pray, but I just wasn't getting anything out of it. You know, I used to believe them, but I wasn't getting anything. You know, I used to go to a place regularly and where there was singing and someone would talk about the Bible, but you know, I just wasn't getting anything. You know, I used to go to a small group and, you know, I just wasn't getting anything. You know, it's not about you getting something out of it. It's about you being faithful. And not only that, I guarantee you, if we stop doing those things, it is guaranteed you will not get anything out of it. Absolutely guaranteed. So much of our life is just accepting where we are, going the right direction, and waiting on God. One of the guilty pleasures I have, and actually it's not a pleasure, it's often a painful thing, is to read what bloggers say about me. And one way I can do that easily is go to Amazon.com. I wrote a book a while ago called Free Book, and I'll go on Amazon.com, and I'll go to the reviews. Here it is right here. I'll click on all the reviews, click, and I can actually go on most recent reviews first, and I did this yesterday morning, hadn't done it for a while, and here's one of the recent reviews I hadn't read yet. Freedom to use the pages as toilet paper. This is the most repetitive book I have read since Lorvin Mueller's book titled, He's Got the Whole World in His Hands. The author should have titled the book, Free to Write Another Bad Book by Someone Who Shouldn't Be Writing at All. Only in America do you have so many preachers writing awful books. I'm sorry, but being a preacher doesn't make you a good author. If you can't write, create a blog and save some trees. Oh, my goodness. Oh, I'll tell you, there is a day I would have looked at some Minneapolis man, Wejo, who is what? I would have gone to every person in the Minneapolis phone book that had a last name with a W or a J, and I would have blown up their mailbox. Every single, I would have gotten a trunk full of M80s, I would have blown up everybody's mailbox because I can't accept you not thinking highly of me. I can't accept that at all. But actually, right now, no kidding. About 5 seconds that annoyed me, and then beyond that, it didn't. Why? Because I'm growing and accepting disapproval. Why? Because the good news of Jesus is that He accepts me. The good news is, I don't have to be faithful to what you want me to be, because when I'm really aligned and my mind's functioning right, I know that Jesus accepts me. I know that His life is for my life. That is the greatest deal going. It's called deal of grace. I know that I am beautiful, I am good looking always because Jesus is my beauty. He is my identity. He is, and if stuff sags or when stuff sags, my identity isn't tied up in my physical being. Don't read into that one too much. My identity isn't tied up in my physical being. My identity is tied up in who Jesus is. The good news is that I don't have to work off my issues because Jesus already worked it off by going to the cross. And so therefore, I can accept, I should, when I'm spiritually sane, I can accept the stuff that's happened to me that isn't good, because it's not about me having a good life. It's about me being faithful to Jesus, and He is my faithfulness because He has always been faithful. I mean, see how this twist is? It's a unique thing that this is why it's called the good news of the gospel. The good news is so good news. How do you respond when you get criticized? I'll tell you what, if you get criticized and it devastates you, it's because you're faithful to your own self-image. It's because you're faithful to what people think about you. How we deal with criticism or people thinking that we did something wrong tells a lot about where our life is going. Okay, last point. Three little bank shot points for you. Boom, 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 boom. Blessings of obedience. Boy, it just sounds so weird to say. Blessings of obedience. It's like oxymoron. It doesn't go together. Three things. One, clarity. Clarity. One of the blessings of obedience is when you settle whatever it is you're going to be obeying, whatever it is, it gives you a clarity in all of your decisions. I settled a long time ago that I am going to be obedient to God. Now, I have not done that all the time. I do disobedient things every day, and I got to deal with it. But I tell you what, when you are recognizing where you're going, whose image you're trying to reflect, decisions become clear. You, there's an obvious answer to this one. I'm going to do this one. I just got our family just got a new puppy. He's 10 weeks old. His name is Winston. All the ladies always do that, you know. On three, let's just go aw on three. One, two, three. Aw, yeah. Yeah, little Winston. And he's actually not very fun or happy right now at all because he's not understanding. There's certain things that have to come out of his body outside the house, not inside the house. So Winston and I have a little bit of a battle of the wills going on. And I'll tell you what Winston's problem is. Winston doesn't understand that I have more resolve than he does. Winston doesn't understand that I will always outlast him. Now, this isn't the way it is with everybody in my house, but at least when it comes to me, I will outlast. So we put him in the crate at night. We put him in there, and he doesn't want to go in the crate. He's like, dude, whelp all your wants. Daddy's in bed. You're not getting out. The sooner you get clear on the fact that when you go in there, I'm not coming back, the sooner you'll save your vocal cords. Take him outside. It's hot. He says to himself, why should I come out here to take a dump? I go inside where it's cold. I could take a dump in there. Why? So I take him outside. He's immediately going up the front door. I got to grab him, bring him down the front door. Me, he goes up the front door. I got to grab him and bring him right down to the ivy. He goes right there, grab him. Finally, I'm like, dude, you will lose this every single time. I will not let you win. I am more resolved from you. And so I get a leash. I get a leash, put it on him. And he really thinks that he can outpull that leash. So he comes, dude. Your life is going to go much better as soon as you understand that me and the leash always win. You will stay out here. You will stay out here until you lose 6 ounces, and you will like it. You will. See, Winston's issue is he needs to get really clear that I have a will and capacities that exceed him. When you get clear that there is a God whose will and capacities exceed you, certain decisions that you struggle with right now get very clear. Not easy. Just clear. There is a clarity. So much clutter in life. Like when I get a check, paycheck, or whatever. I mean, I settled a long time ago. There is a set percentage that immediately, boom, comes off. It's clear. I don't even see. I see a certain amount. I don't even see that amount. I see the amount that I'm gonna have left after I give off of that. I got really clear on that basic commandment a long time ago. Clarity. Number two, confidence. There's a confidence that you walk with because you don't have to cower in fear, wondering whether or not God's whacking you or not. There's a confidence that, you know, if you get hit by a bus, you thought, man, me and God, we're fine. We're fine. There's a confidence about you. It says this in the book of Hebrews chapter 10. So do not throw away your confidence. Don't throw it away and chuck it because you're unfaithful. It will be richly rewarded. You need to persevere. You need to accept the situations you're in right now. You need to continue to bring your life into alignment, congruence. You need to defer. You need to persevere so that when you have done the will of God, you will receive what He has promised. There is a confidence that comes from a faithful life that can't come from any self-help seminar. There's just a confidence of, you know, man, I've hit that nail, and I'm going to continue to hit that nail, and that's where I'm going, and that's the God that I know. And also in that verse, the final thing, notice it mentions reward. Gosh, I wish I probably would have said this earlier. I'll say it right now. Here's the reason why I don't give messages like this very often. Is because the way messages like this normally come off is this. Unless you do this, God's not going to like you. Unless you do this, you're not going to get the love of God. Unless you do this, and let me tell you, God lavishes blessings on us no matter what all of us believe, think, or do. We talked about that in the Lavish series. There is grace and love that God brings to us. And so it gets really dangerous to hear this as, if I do this morality, then God's going to accept me and approve me. That's not the way He works. God gives no paychecks. We never do this and God pays us that. That's not the way it works. However, there is certain compensation that comes only from being obedient. One easy thing is, when I'm going the way of God, I'm getting more of God. I'm understanding God because I can't fully understand God when I'm unfaithful. There's a compensation there. And there's also blessings, I believe, that come in this life that only come when you're faithful. It's a compensation. The Bible talks so many times, too, about when you get to heaven, if you get to heaven, there are different rewards in heaven for different people. There is different compensation. I tell you what, I make no bones about it. Man, I want as much as I can get. And one of the ways I want to encourage God to build into me is I want to be obedient to Him. I have a friend of mine who's a couple decades ago, I think it was, he took over a business that was pretty much in foreclosure. The bank came to him and said, you want to take this over, become the majority partner, and work on it from here and build it up. And he did that. And I think the business at that point was $10 million a year. And 20 years or so later, That business generates hundreds of millions of dollars a year, and it's privately owned. And so as a result of this, this guy's sort of a rock star in the business world. People who know him want to get with him, figure out what his secrets are, ask him tips and insights. And it's normally people who, according to him, are troubled in their business. They're having a hard time making traction. And regularly people who are having a hard way in the business world will say something like, yeah, well, you know, as soon as I land this account next month, I mean, I'm going to get in the black. I'm just waiting for this one account to land. Or they'll say, well, this one regulation is going to change, and then it's a game changer. Then we're going to be all good. Or I just have a feeling next quarter is going to be different. And my friend will just stop and say, oh, there's no bags of gold falling from the sky. There's no bag of gold, some phantom account that's going to make you better, some phantom regulation. There's no bags of gold falling from the sky in business. He says there's three ways you make money in business. Number one, you make good business decisions. You get into the right marketplace. You get into the right business. You make good macro business decisions. Number two, you set good business policies and procedures. You have the right handbook. You have the right follow-through. And then number three, you work hard. That's how you make money in business. And whenever I hear that, I think, gosh, man, that's the same way in the spirit realm. There is no bags of gold falling from the sky. I'm sorry to tell you. I'm sorry. God is not dropping bags of the gold on the sky just to make you feel better about you. He's not. The way you make tracks in the spiritual world, it's the same way. Number one, you make big macro spiritual decisions. You say, these certain things I'm going to get clear on, and I'm not going to do those things. I'm going this direction of God. You make a big macro spiritual decision. Then number two, you follow the right spiritual principles. Ten Commandments is a good place to start. There's other ones. You just recognize these are the ones I'm going to do. And number three, you work hard. You work hard because faithfulness is hard. That's why few people are. It's hard work. You think John the Baptist enjoyed this? No. No. He enjoyed all the blessings from it. But man, he became a great, and we celebrate him today and recognize him today because he was faithful, because he deferred, because he was in congruence, and he accepted the things that he couldn't change. I want us to sit right now, and the band's going to do a song. It's about trusting and obeying. It's an ancient hymn. It's juiced up a bit. Trusting and obeying. You know, this is what it comes down to be a great, faithful person before God. Trusting and obeying. So God, as we sit here, I'm asking you to do one final leg of work on us as we think and pray through the thing that's staring us in the face that we need to walk towards. Communicate to us now, we pray.